as it always does whenever I'm traveling. And my poor wife has to shovel.
I hope this is recording now.
Anyway, all right. So, very glad to welcome Chris Fuchs to visit us here again. And we talk about quantum Bayesian coherence.
Well, thank you.
Well, you can see the bottom, can't you?
Yep.
Okay. Well, thank you to the organizers for inviting me here, giving me more work to do. It seems that I have picked up a habit of making an apology to Richard Feynman. I'm not sure why I've chosen this country to do it in. But I started apologizing to him the last time I was here. And today's talk is a continuation of that with a more, what's the phrase when you lay down flat on the ground? Is it prostrate? Not prostrate.
Prostrate.
Okay, well, I'm going to apologize to Richard Feynman even more. So you'll see. You'll see what I'm talking about. I'm going to talk about something that Bayesians call coherence. And I'm going to talk about something that quantum mechanicians call interference or coherence. And I'm going to ask whether we have one idea here, or maybe perhaps we have two ideas here, or perhaps maybe one in the end. So here's something that Feynman says in his lectures on physics, volume 3. One on quantum mechanics, and these are in the first few pages. This is something that I used to think was just hogwash. So he gives the example of the double slit experiment, which I traced directly out of the book. At the top, he has an electron gun. He sends the electrons through a wall with two slits, and he has a little collector back here at the backstop. And he compares the situations where there's nothing placed over either of the slits, and one finds a spot-by-spot pattern buildup that shows something that we would call interference. And then he considers how that compares to the cases where we've blocked one of the holes. And he writes what we're seeing as probability functions, P1, P2, and P12. They refer to the three different potential experiments that we're talking about. What are these probability functions? Well, they're really probabilities for whether the electron will end up on spot X of the screen. So there's one function. Here's another function, P2 of X. And then there's the third one, P1. Of X, and he says the following thing. The result P12 obtained with both holes is clearly not the sum of P1 and P2, the probabilities for each hole alone. In analogy with our water wave experiment, which he had just previously explained, we say there is interference. For our electrons, P12 is not equal to P1 plus P2. Well, I read this passage to my 9-year-old daughter the other day, and she said, well, of course not. She put an integral sign here and a dx, and she said that's 1. And if you do the same thing here, that's 1. And 1 plus 1 is 2. And I don't know why no one's ever caught that. Maybe someone has caught it, but I've never seen anyone say, you know, in the opening lecture, Feynman on quantum mechanics, he clearly says something that, well, of course you'd say that's not equal. But that's not what he meant. You know, you could put a 1/2 in front of this one, a 1/2 in front of that one, and then the normalization would work. And you would preserve that if you put, say, 1/2. You would have to put the prior probabilities for going to the two holes here. Anyway, what I thought was hogwash was the statement that he says right below it. We shall tackle immediately the basic element of the mysterious behavior in its most strange form. We choose to examine a phenomenon which is impossible, absolutely impossible to explain in any classical way, and which has in it, the heart of quantum mechanics. In reality, it contains the only mystery of quantum mechanics. So here this was, 1964, in fact, the same year as Bell's first paper, wasn't it? Was that 1964?
Yes.
Okay. And
it was published.
And we have Richard Feynman saying that this, the phenomenon of interference, is in fact the only mystery of quantum mechanics, and well, and what really was the use of Bell inequalities and all their development afterward. So, for a long time, I thought that that really was the case, that this phenomenon really doesn't capture the only mystery of quantum mechanics. I have been inclined to believe, and continue to be inclined to believe, that the real mystery is captured right here, and its connection to quantum mechanics, the EPR criterion of reality. That is, and I know you guys have seen it, but I'll read it anyway just to set the context. If without in any way disturbing a system, I added this phrase so that it makes sense, one can gather the information required to predict with certainty, i.e. with probability equal to unity, the value of a physical quantity, then there exists an element of physical reality corresponding to this physical quantity. It's not this that contains the essential mystery of quantum mechanics, but this in relation to considerations about this. Cases where we have two entangled systems, described, for instance, by a maximally entangled state. Suppose we assume the EPR criterion of reality and consider making measurements on one half of this bipartite system. We might consider measuring one observable, which is one orthogonal basis, or a non-commuting observable, a different orthogonal basis. And let us assume locality. What I mean by that is let us assume that nothing we do here can instantaneously affect the real factual state of affairs over here. Well, they thought, EP and R thought, that they had put a dent in quantum mechanics. Because notice the following. I can consider one observable on the left-hand side, this one. I make a measurement of it. I get one of three possible outcomes. So one of my fingers starts glowing red and the other two start glowing green. And as soon as I do that, I know that I can go to the other system, if I wish, perform the appropriate measurement. And now the way I have it depicted here is as if these were exactly the same bases. But really, this is the transpose of this one with respect to something. I can go from here over to there, make that measurement, and I can predict which outcome I will get with certainty. So under the assumption of locality, EP and R say, it must be the case that there is an element of reality over here corresponding to outcome number two. But I can run exactly this argument for a different observable, one that doesn't commute with the original one. And I know that if I get outcome number two for this observable, I can go over to the other side and predict with certainty that I will find outcome two. I haven't touched this. I haven't disturbed this system in any way. Yet I'm making a prediction of certainty. So EP and R would say there's an element of reality on that side corresponding to that observable. So there we are again. We're considering making measurements here. From that, drawing inferences about what we will find over here, we seem to be able to identify two elements of reality, one corresponding to each basis, and yet quantum mechanics doesn't give a complete story of that. Quantum mechanics doesn't give me the possibility of describing the coexistence of these values. Well, the trouble is that kind of reasoning runs into trouble, trouble, trouble. Trouble three times in one sentence. Because I can do this with many bases. For each basis that I can consider, I can draw the conclusion that there must be an element of reality over on the far side over here.
I consider this basis, there's an element of reality. I consider this basis, there's an element of reality. And if I do that for enough bases, as Koshin and Specker pointed out, I'll find a contradiction. I'll find that I assume that there's an element of reality here, so for these three fingers, one of them is colored red. Maybe it's this one. Then I can consider a different basis. And, well, for that basis, because it's aligned with the first on that vector, this too will be colored red, because I can make a probability one assertion about it. And then so forth, and so forth. I can consider all of these bases, always assuming that there's a red, green, green pattern. And eventually I'll walk back on myself and find a spot that I had previously colored green, and it will now be red.
It's still a two-dimensional Hilbert space on the right side, right? So you need three dimensions there, right?
Well, that's what I was attempting to depict.
Yeah, so
I have a three-dimensional Hilbert space.
Yeah, you have to have some more general thing than just the ordinary EPRB experiment. Then. Yeah.
I'm sorry, I didn't say that explicitly, but by writing three orthogonal elements.
Yes.
Did I say?
Yeah.
Oh, no, I think it's written. See, Hans, you have to read. Is it written on that?
Yes,
it's
Q-trace.
Oh, the summation is from 1 to 3 as well.
Well, the summation is to 3. Ah, Q-trace.
Yeah.
Q-trace. So I need dimension 3 and above to use this kind of argument. This kind of argument is not a Bell inequality violation argument. Instead, it's a combination of using an entangled state to ensure the idea that when I gather my information, I'm not causing a direct physical disturbance. And it's also using the non-colorability result of Koshin and Specker, or this one of Perez, who gave an example of 33 rays, such that if you complete the set of rays that are formed by taking the center of the cube, taking the lines that go from the center of the cube out through these points, and then completing them so that we have a full set of 40 triads, I think it comes to, then I'll get a contradiction there. Or I could have run the same sort of argument with two, not Q-trits, but whatever the four-dimensional versions are, Q-quats.
Well, I also need to assume non-contextuality, right, that your index figure remains being your index figure if you rotate your tour.
Well, what I'm assuming are two things. I'm assuming locality, that's one. And so from the locality, I'm assuming one thing. I'm assuming locality.
And the
EPR criterion of reality.
Exactly.
And then I'm running into a contradiction.
Well,
so here's what locality does for you. I make a measurement here. Okay? Then from this measurement, let's say I get this one go off. Then what I tell myself is for any observable, well, quantum mechanics gives me the following ability. For any observable that contains this as one of its outcomes, I will predict outcome. I'll predict this guy as the outcome. If I were to go over here.
Yeah, but that's the thing with non-contextuality.
Quantum mechanics tells me that.
Yeah, but that's if you're
so quantum mechanics tells me that, and the EPR criterion of reality, coupled with the idea of locality, says I'm going to say that there's an element of reality over here.
Yeah.
Because I have a disturbance.
I understand. It's just that when you have two measurements which share one common, say, in the case of pure of objective measurements, share one common projector, you need to assume that this projector corresponds to the same property in these two measurements, even though in the lab these two measurements might be completely different actual physical operations. You somehow are saying that this light going red here is the same thing as this light going red here, because in my quantum mechanical descriptions, these two things correspond to the same projection.
I guess maybe in some weak sense I am, because at least the way I tried to phrase it was this. I perform the measurement here, and then I take my little piece of laboratory equipment over here, and I plunk it down, and I do the same thing again. So, indeed, I'm making an identification between that piece of laboratory equipment and this piece of laboratory equipment.
I'm identifying the same outcome in two different measurements as being the same outcome.
He's deriving that from locality and the criteria.
Yes.
Because
I think so. I don't want this to be the main point of the talk, though. But
I think Eric's right, actually.
Because
in effect, you're you're assuming contextuality over on the far side. I mean, in order to get the thing to which you're applying the criterion of reality.
Well, what I'm assuming overall is just quantum mechanics. So you can split it up into little statements of. Don't let me be derogatory. Little statements of this and little statements of that. But quantum mechanics tells me if I perform a certain measurement here, and then I go perform exactly the same measurement here, I'll get the same outcome. I haven't gone so far as to say, oh, there's a whole equivalence class of things that I could do over here. At least in my statement, I haven't gone so far as to say there's a whole equivalence class of various things that I can do over here, and the outcomes of those guys will coincide because of some property called non-contextuality. I've just said if I take a piece of laboratory equipment here, I get outcome one for it, and then I carry that piece of laboratory equipment over here, I will get outcome one for it again. So therefore, there is an element of reality corresponding.
Do you still disagree? It's just a spectral contradiction that you need to
assume.
You just use a no-covering theorem. It's just identifying the outcomes as being corresponding to the same direction in the sphere you're trying to cover. That's when you use no-contextuality.
If you have the measurement on the left-hand side that contains a projector, right? So then you suppose there's an element of reality of the pole. But the thing is, if you then do a different, you then have to do a different measurement that shares the same projector, you're having to assume that it's the same element of reality.
No. You're just doing one measurement over here, and that allows you to infer for any measurement you might do on the other side, which contains that, regular that, you'll get that result.
Okay.
So you get an independence of the other basis elements on the far side. Great.
I think you do, but so these could all be different properties, why not?
I wonder whether I should hang on this point or whether I should. Whether I should go on.
Your call.
Is it an important point for the rest of the
talk? No, I was just going to explain my attitude. but you know, maybe that's revealing. So, how to negotiate this? For the moment, maybe I can say, maybe I'll say, well, Eric, I'll concede some, and maybe that's okay. Maybe it won't hurt the point that I do want to make. I'm not sure that I can do that. But let's, for the sake of argument, say I can concede some. Maybe I am making a hidden non-contextuality assumption that I had not appreciated. But I don't see those words non-contextuality here. So here's all I want to say. When one sees this, and one sees this, let's say like Alan Stairs did, this is Alan Stairs' argument, effectively. One can make one of two moves. Maybe there are more moves, but there's at least two moves that one can make. One of them is to say that the beginning of this is negated, if without in any way disturbing a system. So often people will say, well, what's really been revealed here is that making a measurement here is disturbing this system. This is the idea of quantum, not as locality, but quantum non-locality. That's one move one can make. I, on the other hand, am actually happier with just saying that there's something broken about this criterion of reality. And the reasons for that are long and many, and I don't want to go into why I think that this is broken over the other idea being broken, but I'm going to assume that the thing that we learn from this phenomenon is that there's something wrong with this idea, this criterion of reality. And it's captured by this phrase of Asher Peres. I was just teaching at the Asher Peres School for Physics, and I tried to heap a lot of praise on him, so I'll do it one more time. I like this phrase, unperformed experiments have no results. And I think that's the lesson that we take away from from the stairs kinds of considerations. Let's go back to Feynman. So I said that Feynman said that in essence what was going on in quantum mechanics is interference, and then I said, well, that didn't feel right to me. I much preferred the kinds of considerations that we just went through. But a little bit further in the same chapter, one can find this thing of Feynman, where he says, is it true or is it not true that the electron either goes through hole one or it goes through hole two? The only answer that can be given is that there is a certain special way that we have to think in order that we do not get into inconsistencies. The only thing that we can say is that there is a certain special way that we have to think in order that we do not get into inconsistencies. What we must say to avoid making wrong predictions is the following. If one looks at the holes, or more accurately, if one has a piece of apparatus which is capable of determining whether the electrons go through hole one or hole two, then one can say that it goes either through hole one or hole two. But when one does not try to tell which way the electron goes, when there is nothing in the experiment to disturb the electrons, then one may not say that an electron goes either through hole one or hole two. If one does say that and starts to make any deductions from the statement, he will make errors in the analysis. This is the logical tightrope on which we must walk if we wish to describe nature successfully. My interpretation of all of that is that in this paragraph, he... Thank you. I left a lot behind. I thought maybe I left one or two. That's why I couldn't finish my talk for this one. Oh, no, I better not put it there. I'll forget it again. So my interpretation of what Feynman was shooting to get at was pithily summarized by this thing that Asher Peres said. Once again, that in the two different situations that Feynman had considered previously, there are two different experiments. And that they're not, or three different experiments, in fact, and they're not commensurate in terms of each other. There's the one experiment where both holes are open. There's a different experiment when one of them is closed and the other one is open, and there's still a different experiment. And what one is attempting to do, for instance, in writing a statement like this, is to say that there is a way of thinking of the one experiment in terms of the other two. And can't do that. That's what that's about. So I feel like from two different starting points, they're trying to get to something that is about the same. One more Feynman quote, and then we'll move on to other things. In an earlier paper, where he goes through much of the same argument that he gives to students in his 64 lectures in 1951, in this paper, The Concept of Probability in Quantum Mechanics, he says something that, with my present inclinations, really strikes me as being on the right path. The new theory asserts that there are experiments for which the exact outcome is fundamentally unpredictable, and that in these cases, one has to be satisfied with computing probabilities of various outcomes. But far more fundamental was the discovery that in nature, the laws of combining probabilities were not those of the classical probability theory of Laplace. So nature is indeterministic, but far more fundamental than that, he says, is that we're learning these new rules for combining probabilities. I should say that in spite of the implication of the title of this talk, the concept of probability is not altered in quantum mechanics. When I say the probability of a certain outcome of an experiment is P, I mean the conventional thing. That is, if the experiment is repeated many times, one expects that the fraction of those which give the outcome in question is roughly P. I will not be at all concerned with analyzing or defining this concept in more detail, for no departure from the concept used in classical statistics is required. What is changed, and changed radically, is the method of calculating probabilities. Well, okay, so I say I like something here. I like this part of it. In spite of the implications of the title of this talk, the concept of probability is not altered in quantum mechanics.
I say, right.
I think that's on track. When I say the probability of a certain outcome of an experiment is P, I mean the conventional thing. I think that's exactly right. That is, if the experiment is repeated many times.
I'm a Bayesian.
And that doesn't make any sense to me. So there's part of the statement that I think is on the right track, and there's part of it that I think is on the wrong track. That in quantum mechanics, the notion of probability doesn't change. It starts as Bayesian probability, and it ends as Bayesian probability. But what does change, and what does change radically, is the method of calculating probabilities, and that's what the bigger piece of this talk is about. So I want to show you how to make a statement like this in more modern terminology. So let me first go to what I mean by probabilities. He told us what he meant by probabilities, the thing that doesn't change. And here's what I think by probabilities, the thing that doesn't change. And that is that probability gets its definition through gambling behavior. So when one declares, so here's this bookie here, and he has placed a little poster up saying that the probability of event E is P sub E, and the probability of event not E is P sub not E, and the probability of E or F is this symbol. When he declares these values, what he means is that he will buy or sell a lottery ticket. So you go up there and you give some money, or he or someone brings you one of the tickets that he had previously sold you. And the ticket is worth $1 if E occurs. So declaring P sub E means that one will buy or sell a lottery ticket of this form, worth $1 if E, for this amount, P sub E dollars. So that's just the very definition of what one means by probability. Now you might say to yourself, why should I believe that these numbers have anything to do with probability theory? And as stated with this definition, there's nothing that compels these numbers to have any connection to probability theory as we know it. Instead, one gets that connection by laying a little bit more structure on. And here's the extra structure. I'll call it a normative rule. Never declare a probability, like P of E, P of not E, so forth, that will lead to a sure loss. So that's going to be the one requirement that we have on these numbers. I should not write down numbers that will lead to a sure loss no matter what the outcome of the experiment or the event is. So let me give you an example. From this normative rule, you can get the idea that probabilities have to be greater than or equal to zero. Why? Well, suppose that the probability of E, suppose you write down a number, P sub E, that's less than zero. Then that means the guy behind the desk will sell a ticket for negative money. So he says, here, take a ticket, and here, take some money. Well, he loses money no matter what then. So he should never write down P E that's less than zero. Alternatively, he should never write down a P of E that's greater than one. Why? The bookie will buy a ticket for more than it's worth. So you come up to him with a ticket, and it's worth $1. And he says, here, I'm going to give you $1.25 for it. He loses money automatically. So he should never write down a number, P of E, that's greater than 1. So we've just, from this little rule, gotten the idea that probabilities are between 0 and 1. You can get more of the structure. For instance, consider a case where we've got two events, E and F, that are mutually exclusive. E and F are mutually exclusive. Let us consider lottery tickets of this structure. One of them is worth $1 if E or F. And then we've got two other tickets, maybe, worth $1 if E. One of them is worth $1 if F. But clearly, buying these two tickets is equivalent to buying that ticket. Because if you bought these two tickets, you'll win $1 in exactly the case when you win $1 up here. And you'll not make any money at all in exactly the same case
as if you had bought that. So clearly these two are worth that. So it had better be the case that probability of E or F is equal to P of E plus P of F. So from the normative rule, we've got another rule of probability that's standard. Here's another example. This is what I'm going to need for the next transparency. Suppose somebody offers you a ticket that's not worth $1, but worth M over N dollars if E. So previously we had defined everything in terms of tickets that are worth $1 if. Now we're talking about a ticket that's worth some fraction of a dollar if E. What price would you pay for that? Well, you would not pay P of E, but M over N times P of E. And the reason for this is essentially the same reason as this. So I'll leave that one as an exercise. You can go work it out for yourself that if you don't pay this amount for this ticket, you will have a sure loss. Now here's the important one, and the important one for the rest of the discussion on quantum mechanics. It's Bayes' rule. So from the Bayesian point of view, where does one get Bayes' rule? You get it by considering conditional lotteries. So what I mean by that are lotteries of this form. If E and F both occur, then we give the full price of a ticket. But if not F, if not one of the events, then we return the money. So this is called a conditional lottery. So what we're talking about are tickets of this structure. It's worth $1 if E and F. And if, so here we're going to pay this much for it. Suppose this is the price for this kind of ticket. It's P, E, bar, F. That's the price for it. That's what we'd pay. This is what we'd buy or sell this ticket for. So if we pay this much for a ticket, then the ticket is of this structure. It's worth $1 if E and F. Was I saying or a while ago? I hope I wasn't. Well. And if not F, then just give the money back. So in other words, give exactly this amount back. But you can notice that this ticket should be worth exactly the same thing as these two tickets are. So this ticket is worth $1 if E and F. There's the price, by definition. And this one is worth P, E bar F, if not F. Well, you take the thing that you would have paid for the $1 ticket, which is P of not F, and you multiply it by the price that this one pays. There. This ticket should be worth the same thing as these two because they express exactly the same idea. So then you must have, you'd better have this, that whatever you pay for this guy up here, PE bar F, is equal to the price of this ticket plus the price of that ticket. And then you use a little bit of logic on this, and you put this, rearrange this equation, and you get the standard Bayes' rule, which says that the probability of E and F is equal to the probability of F times the probability of E given F. So that's what I mean by probability theory. Feynman meant long-run frequency. I mean by probability theory the idea that probability is how much you would buy or sell a lottery ticket for, point number one. Point number two is some normative condition that says you should not gamble in such a way that you will have a sure loss. And from that, you get the structure of probability, and particularly for us, you get Bayes' rule from considering conditional lotteries. And that's going to be important in a little while, and I'll come back to this. So here's the way my collaborators, Schock and Caves and Appleby and sometimes Matt Liefer, think of things. There's a bedrock underneath anything that we do in physics is called probability theory. And you can tell that probability theory, at least if you take this Bayesian conception of probability, this stuff has nothing to do with physics. It all had to do with gambling. There's no statement about physics in it. When you get to physics, you take this bedrock, you take this structure, and you start building things on top of it.
like that. You make particular uses of probability theory, and in particular, you might tell yourself, well, I shouldn't write down, I shouldn't just have coherence in the sense that I was just talking about, these Dutch book rules, but maybe I should make further restrictions on my probability assignments because I'm taking into account the fact that I'm dealing with the physical world now. I would do something similar if I took probability theory to horse racing. If I went into a gambling house and I start betting on horses, maybe I know some things, and I don't use all probabilities that are available, or I don't use all potential relations between them, but I use some subset because I tailor my gambling to the subject matter. So this is our point of view about quantum probabilities. One starts with probability theory. You don't say classical probability theory. You just say probability theory. It has nothing to do with classical physics. And then on top of that, you may add some extra structure. What sorts of things might be considered extra structure? Well, here's the obvious one. It's called the Born rule. And this is the way it's usually stated. Suppose I'm considering measuring some observable, so some set of orthogonal basis vectors. I'm going to measure this guy. I calculate the probability of outcome J of this measurement according to the Born rule. And the way, now here's where I should say it, it's the way it's usually stated. Somebody give, if I give you the quantum state rho, and you've said you're going to measure this observable, you take the quantum state and you take the observable, you multiply them together, take the trace, and that calculates the probability for you. So here's an addition to just Dutch book coherence. You've got Dutch book coherence with all of your probabilities, and somebody comes in and says, here's the rule for calculating probabilities. It's something extra. Well, I can't disagree with that. But the way that I've stated it, I give you the quantum state and then you calculate the probability, is effectively asking you to think of the quantum state as something prior, logically prior to the probabilities. This thing called the quantum state has an existence on its own, not just in probability statements. It's something else. I give you the something else, and then from the something else, you make your probability calculations. It seems that in the philosophy of science community, or a large fraction of the philosophy of science community, the way they think of that is along the lines of something that David Lewis called the principal principle. Now let me tell you about the principal principle. For Lewis and for followers, and I don't know who else, and Janann, I think, I wish she were here, for those guys, there are Bayesian probabilities, the kind that I just defined in terms of Dutch book arguments. That's one thing. But then there are also these things called objective chances. They're not Bayesian probabilities. They're facts about the world. And Lewis's principal principle gives us a way of connecting our Bayesian probabilities to these objective chances that are out in the world. I almost put metaphysical on this transparency, and then I thought better of it. Because I thought Janann would really get angry at me. But she's not here, so I'm going to say there are Bayesian probabilities and then there are these metaphysical chances. So the principle goes like this. For any agent out there who is willing to write down his Bayesian probabilities for some event A, or his degrees of belief, or his gambling commitments like we were talking about a little while ago, for any such agent, if I hand him the chances, if I make him aware of what the true chance of the event is, so that he has this statement, the chance of A is X, and suppose he even has any other kind of statement in the back of his mind that's compatible with that. So what I mean by something that's compatible with it is, for instance, he can't have the information that the coin actually will give heads, because that would be giving him too much information. But the idea is give him anything that doesn't directly contradict this. Then he should adjust his Bayesian degrees of belief to be exactly what the chance is. It almost seems contentless to most physicists. And there's probably a reason for why it seems contentless. To talk in a sarcastic way, I think it probably is contentless. But philosophers of science really like this idea, that the way you should gamble, if you're told the true chance of an event, is to adjust your gambling commitments to the true chance. Similarly, one might think of quantum states, that for any observer, if I reveal the quantum state, psi, in other words, if I reveal the chance of outcome J and any compatible information, then he should write down his Bayesian degrees of belief to be in accordance with exactly that value. So there are these objective things called quantum states, and then there are Bayesian degrees of belief, and the two come together from, I think, this chancy point of view according to something that's very much like a principle. Well, so that is one way I think that one can sort of fill in this picture. There's probability theory, and then what we're adding on top of probability theory is a particular usage of Lewis's principle, a particular style of usage of Lewis's principle. I don't like that move, and the main reasons I don't like that move are precisely two things that cause a lot of trouble in quantum foundations. Here's one of them expressed by Jim Hartle in 68. A quantum state being a summary of the observer's information about an individual physical system changes both by dynamical laws and whenever the observer acquires new information about the system through the process of measurement. The existence of two laws for the evolution of the state vector becomes problematical only if it is believed that the state vector is an objective property of the system. If the state of a system is defined as a list of experimental propositions together with their probabilities of occurrence, it is not surprising that after a measurement, the state must be changed to be in accord with the new information. The reduction of the wave packet does take place in the consciousness of the observer, not because of any unique physical process which takes place there, but only because the state is a construct of the observer and not an objective property of the physical system. Effectively, that paragraph is a call to say, you shouldn't think of these probabilities as any more objective than usual Bayesian probabilities. The reason being, if you think that they are objective, then you will think of the quantum state as objective. And the quantum state, we know that we can evolve it unitarily, and we know that when we perform a measurement, there's this thing called a collapse. If you think of the quantum state as an objective state of affairs, then you had better give an explanation for why the nice unitary evolution stops and a collapse occurs. So now the burden is on you to provide a mechanism. If you take away the idea that this is an objective statement, it's just a gambling commitment, then it's no surprise that when you, the gambler, gets more information, you'll change your state. You'll change your expectations, you'll change your gambling commitments. The other one is this. It's a variant of what we were already talking about. Suppose we have two systems in an entangled state. We make a measurement on the left one, and we assume that making measurements here or having any kind of interaction here doesn't instantaneously affect things over there. Well, if we measure this basis up versus down, afterward, we will write down a new quantum state for system B. We make a measurement here on A. We will immediately write down a new quantum state for system B, and it'll be one of these two. But if we had instead measured this observable, right versus left, afterward we'd write down one of these two states. So by performing measurements over here, we toggle the quantum state over there. If one takes the quantum state to be an objective feature of nature, one has to give an explanation for how it was that making a measurement here really did affect things over there. If one adopts the opposite idea, that quantum states are subjective, this is from back in the days when I used to call it information, then this problem goes away. You have an interaction here. The interaction teaches you something about that. You change your description of it. So I'm reluctant to adopt a principle-principle type approach to understanding quantum probabilities. And instead, I would like to say that this addition to raw probability theory that's captured by the Born rule must be signifying something else. So as I understand Janann, she would say there's raw probability theory, and then you add a principle-principle-like thing. That's what the something else is. Now, I'd like to say, well, I do have to add this. So I am adding something on top, but it's not going to be a principle-principle-type statement. We're running out of time.
In theory, you have 2 minutes, including discussion. But I really wanted to say something about the principle-principle. Can't just suffer that
okay.
in silence. You are misrepresenting the principle-principle, really. I mean, principle-principle is an implicit definition of what chances are, if there are such things.
Yep.
So the idea is if there is anything out there in the world such that you as an agent are rationally constrained to give assign such degrees of belief to certain events, those things out there are the chances. And Lewis leaves it open whether chances actually exist out there or not. And in fact, part of what he's part of his problem is because he's a Humean, thinks that everything that's out there should be matters of particular fact, so that space-time points. The problem is, can there be such a thing as chances? The way you presented the principle-principle the way you just said Janann thing, that's not it.
Okay. That's fair enough. And I think the way you said it a minute ago, I think I understood that this is the purpose of the principle-principle, to say if there are such things as chances, this is how they are. And maybe I should leave Janann completely out of this. I should have. I'm troubled with thinking of that statement as a statement of chance. And the reason, so this is the thing that I'm really trying to get at, that the reason I would reject that this is giving me a species of chance is because of the two problems, one wave function collapse and one of them action at a distance. So if I drop both of those things, I say I understand quantum mechanics a little better. And the reason I gained a little understanding is I dropped the idea that this represents the objective chance. Now that doesn't seem to have too much to do with the principle-principle, does it?
No.
Not a whole lot. The main reason I was bringing up the principle-principle in this context is I was thinking that a chance theorist would say, of course, there's probability theory, and then there's something added in. Those are chances, and the principle-principle.
Yeah.
And the principle-principle's use of the chances.
If you can construct, if you assume that quantum states are objective, and then you can construct an argument why they should rationally constrain your probabilities, as, for instance, Deutsch and Wallace tried to do,
right. Then
they represent objective chances. But
you
deny that they are objective, that quantum states are objective in the first place, and so they can't play the role of determining chances.
Perfect. That's right. But I still have this. And so I'd like to understand what on earth this means if it's not a statement of an objective chance. And the idea that we're playing with, and one that we think we've made a lot of progress on recently, is that rather we would like to see the Born rule as an addition to Dutch book coherence. So it's not a rule now that specifies probabilities, but rather a rule that relates probabilities in the same way that coherence relates probabilities. How can I best see that? That there may be some content to this kind of statement. The only way that I know to see it at the moment is to start working in representations of quantum mechanics where I get rid of quantum states altogether and put in their place distribution function representations of quantum states. So I'd like to find a representation of quantum states in terms of single probability distributions. If I can do that, then I'm starting to put myself in a place where I can make direct comparisons between the Bayesian idea of probability and probabilities as given by the Born rule. And many of you have already seen this many times, but here's the method. I introduce a very special measuring device. Somewhere up in the sky or in the Bureau of Standards, there's a very special measuring device that I consider. And whenever I have a quantum state, rho, in place of writing down a probability, in place of writing down a quantum state, what I do is consider the case of taking this system up to the Bureau of Standards and dropping it into the measuring device. The measuring device will give me one click or another. I can't generally predict the outcomes of the click, but I can write down a probability distribution for the outcomes. And the idea is that that probability distribution should uniquely characterize this quantum state rho, so that I create a one-to-one correspondence between this mathematical object and that mathematical object. And you can do this. You can find such measurements that have this property, ones that uniquely specify quantum states. For that, though, you can't use regular old von Neumann measurements. Instead, you have to use generalized measurements or positive operator valued measures. These, for everybody knows what a POVM is, or a generalized measurement in this audience? Good. So all I'm doing is I'm dropping the requirement that the operators, the measurement operators, are orthogonal to each other. So instead of always putting my fingers up like an orthogonal basis, I might now put my fingers up like this to represent that the different operators aren't orthogonal to each other. And even though I'm in, for instance, a three-dimensional Hilbert space, my POVMs can have many outcomes, many more than the dimension of the space. Once I free myself up and use measurements of that variety, then I can particularly consider informationally complete ones. So an informationally complete measurement, informationally complete POVM, is one that has at least as many elements as the dimensionality of density operator space. And all of these guys have to be linearly independent. So actually, I want precisely d squared of them. So I have a dimensionality's worth for the state space, all of these guys being linearly independent. If I have such a measurement, and I use the Born rule to calculate my probabilities, then I can notice the following thing. The Born rule is just a statement of an inner product between two vectors up in this space. So trace of rho EH is the same thing as the inner product between rho and EH with respect to the Hilbert-Schmidt inner product. So the probabilities for the outcomes represent the projection of one vector onto these basis vectors. So if I have all of these numbers, if I have all of the projections onto a complete basis, I can completely reconstruct the quantum state. I can reconstruct the vector itself. So if I have a POVM with this characteristic, then I have a way of mapping quantum states to probability distributions. Well, there's a lot of them. So, you know, I say it can be done, but I should say it can be done easily. There's a continuous infinity of such measurements that one can invent. And different classes of such measurements have different classes of properties. I was going to show you the general story of them, but I think I won't. I'll just jump to the one I want. In the class of all measurements, all informationally complete measurements, there's one particularly sweet class that might or might not exist. We don't know yet. A lot of people think it does exist. If it does exist, it'll have some very nice properties. Let me show you that class. This is a question that arose in 1999 when we were working on something else in Cave's group, and also a guy in Germany, Zauner, independently posed this question. And we never saw much use for it until recently. But here's the question. Suppose you have a d-dimensional Hilbert space, Can you find d squared projection operators, d squared one-dimensional projection operators, such that if you take the trace of the product of any two of them, it's equal to a particular constant value? Can you always do that? Well, why might you want to do that?
And well, by a constant, you mean just a function of the dimension?
Just a function of the dimension. So why might you want such a set of projection operators? And the reason you might is anytime you have a set of projection operators such that the trace of the product is equal to a constant, you can prove just a few lines, don't follow it now, but you can prove in just a few lines that that set of projection operators has to be linearly independent. So if you have d squared of them and they have these constant inner products, then they must be a linearly independent set. Well, I said if you have d squared of them. Here I just have m of them. And so now you notice one thing. They have to be a linearly independent set. That gives an upper bound to how large this value m can be. M, the number of them, cannot be larger than the dimensionality of the operators on the space. When the space is a real vector space, it's a half d, d plus 1. When the space is a complex space, it's d squared. Well, here's something kind of nice about the real case. Well, it wasn't considered nice by the people who were working on this problem. Here's the dimension. Here's this upper bound that I just showed you. In very low dimensions, dimension 2 and 3, the actual maximum number, m, is equal to the upper bound. But by the time you get to dimension 4, the maximum value that m can take is not equal to the upper bound anymore. When you get down to dimension 7, apparently the two are equal again. So when Hilbert spaces are real, there's a very complicated structure for the maximum number of these guys that can be linearly independent. The surprising thing, though, is even though this bound is generally not achievable, one for the complex case appears to be. And we know this in dimensions 2 through 47, where computer techniques have played out. There have been some constructions for, 14 dimensions at least. You can see that they exist. So the general quantum information community believes that such projections do always exist. It just hasn't been proven yet. Well, what do you do with them? If they do exist, we can use them in our Bureau of Standards. And now is when I start rushing very quickly because I know I'm far over time. So if they do exist, then it turns out the constant value that depends upon dimension is fixed. It can only be 1 over d plus 1. As I've already told you, they're linearly independent. If we renormalize them, they sum up to the identity, so they'd be a good measurement for the Bureau of Standards. And if I work out the expression of a general density operator in terms of the probabilities for the outcomes, I get this very simple expression. There's a very simple relation between the probabilities of outcomes and the expansion coefficients in an expansion that makes use of that basis. Okay. So if these guys exist, you get a mapping from quantum states to probability distributions that's 1-to-1. But you don't actually get a mapping that is onto. So if you think of the space of probability distributions, that's this space, set of points on a simplex over d squared outcomes. There is a region that corresponds to valid density operators, and there's an outside region that corresponds to invalid quantum states. So these are valid probability distributions, but they don't get mapped to density operators. So it would seem like we've traded a very pretty structure, density operators, for something that actually is a much more complicated shape than the one I've shown here. So we've traded something very pretty, density operators, for probabilities with a funny restriction on them. And if you want to know what the restriction is, it's this. The probabilities just out on the edge are probabilities that lie on a sphere, but then the sphere intersecting some kind of cubic curve. So it looks like a complicated structure, these points out on the edge. Here's what I'd like to know. Whether there's some kind of simple considerations that actually might give us back this complicated shape. And particularly, might it have something to do with Dutch book coherence? And I want to answer that now, and I'll finish up in about 5 minutes, Guido. So let's go back to the laws of probability. Suppose you have some hypothesis HI, and you're considering gathering some data in another experiment, and the various values of the data are DJ. And suppose you're given prior probabilities for the various hypotheses up here, and conditional probabilities for the data given the hypotheses. What expectations should you have for the data itself? Well, Dutch book coherence gives you an answer. It's that you calculate the probabilities for the various pieces of data according to the law of total probability, and you can derive that from a Dutch book argument. A Dutch book argument that, well, because it makes use of these conditional probabilities, must have a conditional lottery hidden in the background. Maybe explicitly so, but there's a conditional lottery there. But I want to ask a different question. I don't want to ask this one, where it's clear that we have a conditional lottery. I'd like to ask a different one. Suppose we're in a situation where we're not talking about hypotheses that might or might not be true, but we're talking about quantum mechanical measurements. And what we have is some measurement down in the laboratory, say some von Neumann measurement in the laboratory. And I want you to calculate the probabilities of outcomes if you take your quantum system and throw it into that von Neumann measurement. What I'm going to give you instead of a quantum state and a description of the measurement, however, is a prior probability for what would happen up in one of these special measurements, the SIC measurement that I just showed you, the really pretty measurement. So I give you the prior probabilities for the outcomes of this measurement, and moreover, I give you the probabilities for this measurement conditioned on this measurement. So I give you this, and I give you that, and I'd like you to tell me what probability would you assign for outcome J? Well, would you just give me back this answer, the classical answer? And most people who know a little quantum mechanics would say, no, of course you wouldn't do that. Because the probability that's being asked for is the probability of getting outcome J if you go along the bottom path. But if you were to actually go along the top path, that would break coherence, people say. And breaking coherence makes this answer not equal to the classical answer. But this guy is not just any measurement up here. He's a very special one, one that was introduced precisely for clarifying the situation. And here's what the answer is. It's not the classical answer. Instead, you take the classical answer, and then you just modify it ever so slightly by some universal constants. You take the classical answer, and you multiply it by the dimension plus one and subtract one. And that's all that changes in this quantum mechanical case. So I think that's rather neat. For one thing, when we go back to the Feynman case, when he introduced the measurement in the middle, he said, look, it shows you that these probabilities don't sum anymore. What he was really trying to get at was that you don't have the law of total probability anymore. He left out some factors. So it's true that you don't have that anymore. But because you don't have it anymore, Feynman taught us that we should go to amplitude calculus, start using complex amplitudes. What this says is that you can actually use probabilities after all, but you do change something. You change the law of total probability. You can say a little bit more, and I feel like I'm really, really out of time. So actually, I'm not going to tell you the punchline of the talk. So you can say more. You can I had implicitly considered a von Neumann measurement device down here. But one can write down a completely general formula that works for any POVM. It's a little more complicated than the last one. But here's the essential thing about both of these formulas that I want to try to impress on you. Let's go back to this picture. The essential thing is that I'm asking you to calculate a probability, this one, for this path. I'd like you to write it in terms of the probabilities that are generated by going this path. But in this path, there is a conditional lottery. You can register this outcome and look at it and then decide to give the money back or to move forward to the next thing. Along this path, there is no such conditional lottery. So from the Bayesian perspective, there was never any logical reason why the situation with conditional lotteries should be commensurate with the situation without conditional lotteries. Any good Bayesian would have said, I would have never expected this to equal that. One of them has a conditional lottery in the middle of it. The other one doesn't. There's no reason a priori to think that there's any connection. From the quantum perspective, nonetheless, despite this criticism, there may be, and it seems to be, empirical reasons for actually adopting a relation between this and this. And the point is, we think this is the content of the Born rule. And since I'm out of time and it would take me too long to go through it, I'll just tell you this. One can consider more general situations than I did previously. Forget about quantum mechanics and just consider a general situation, much like we have in quantum mechanics, where we're considering a factual path to a counterfactual path, and try to write our probabilities for the factual path in terms of our counterfactual path, and just assuming as a fundamental postulate something of the form that I showed you previously, that these probabilities are determined from these other things, but not by the classical relation where this is gone and that's one, but instead we add a little bit more freedom. And it turns out playing with that fundamental postulate and adding just a little bit more structure, it seems that there is an awfully good chance that with adding a little bit of structure, we end up back with these equations that we have for the quantum state space. So I'll have to give you that on faith because I was too slow of a presenter. And I'll just end by saying this. We're looking for students. And if there's anyone out there who wanted to hear the end of the story or wants to work on the end of the story, I have two scholarships I can give, so just write me. Thank you. I asked for 5 more minutes. I should have asked for 1 hour and 5 more minutes.
Right. Well, I suppose there are some questions.
No, probably not.
No? You'd rather not?
No, I don't think there are any questions.
Yeah.
So what happens?
Oh, there is.
What happens if you consider any other informationally complete POVM as opposed to the symmetric one?
Yeah, it breaks.
I mean, does that?
So you don't get such a beautifully simple formula. If there are two requirements to get to the simple formula. So where is the simple formula? So if you put a different one up there,
yeah,
up in the sky, you don't put a symmetric one up in the sky,
yeah,
then there are two requirements on it. Well, so excuse me, I'm not saying it correctly. If you want this formula, you need to satisfy two requirements in this.
Okay.
One of them is that it's symmetric.
Yeah.
And symmetric as I defined it. Yeah. But particularly, the operators have to be rank one.
Right.
If you put an informationally complete one up there that consists of rank ones, rank one elements, then you will get a modification of this formula that has an extra matrix multiplication on the inside of the sum. If you put something up there that has any non-rank one elements, so even if it is symmetric, but non-rank one, then you don't get the formula at all. So you need it to be rank one and symmetric in order to get to that. So that's why I have a lot of interest in the existence of these things. The stuff I showed here today is pretty mathematically trivial. The hard part is proving the existence of such a set of operators. But in connection with Frank's talk this morning, one thing that would come out of this is if one can rederive quantum state space from this program, it automatically implies that the field is complex rather than real, because it already is known to fail if it's real. This situation simply doesn't hold in real quantum mechanics. So the sorts of things that one can get out of this, I shouldn't even show you this, is that by the fundamental postulate of that equation and demanding that it be bounded between 0 and 1, so here's the fundamental guy, making this demand does a lot of things for you. It automatically fixes these values, alpha and beta, to be the ones that we know, and requires that the relation between the numbers n up here and m there be such that m equals m squared. And finally, you can ask, with how many states can you achieve the lower bound? And even though our probability distributions are over d squared outcomes, it turns out that there's never more than d states that achieve the lower bound. So in other words, you get the idea of an orthogonal basis almost for free just from enforcing this inequality.
Okay, so maybe we can thank our speaker a bit and
probabilities without the upper half existing. And so I think Monte Carlo is an institution.